This is KAOS Olympia.
What's up, y'all? This is Markley Morrison, and you are listening to the action-packed 73rd episode of Low Profile. Today, my co-host Madison Nadine and I sit down with Mike Stacks. Mike lives in San Diego. For Kicks, he records and tours with his band, The Loons. But he's better known as a writer, having published the magazine Ugly Things since the early 1980s. Ugly Things is the widely accepted authority on the golden era of obscure underground rock music, and today we'll be talking to Mike about Craig Smith, also known as Maitreya. Go down, swim through the darkness, black water flow away. Red caps sparkle like diamonds, green eyes are glowing. Turning and spinning and losing and winning life's tapestry weaves nothing new. Smith was a rising star in the LA music world in the 1960s until his life was thrown off the rails by a tragic incident. Smith rebounded from the trauma by taking on the spiritual name Maitreya, a self-proclaimed deity among men, and would-be cult leader had he found a devoted following. He faded into obscurity after self-releasing a pair of records, and Mike Stacks took it upon himself to track down Maitreya, or at least as much of his story as possible. His findings resulted in the book Swim Through the Darkness, which is also the title of the song we're hearing now. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to do this morning.
Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
So we're talking about your endeavor, your adventure, looking for an artist named Craig Smith or Maitreya Kali.
Right.
You came to go on this quest after you wrote an article in your magazine, Ugly Things. What is Ugly Things, and how did you come to Craig Smith?
Yeah, sure. Well, Ugly Things was basically a fanzine. Well, it was and is a fanzine that I started back in 1983, I started Ugly Things, and it was basically to sort of tell people about the overlooked bands and artists from 1960s, really. And it sort of grew from being a couple hundred copies, photocopied, to being, you know, something a little bit larger, you know. Now it's been almost 40 years that I've been doing it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Along the way, you know, I'm always looking for interesting untold stories. The whole concept is, you know, all the stories of all the main 60s acts have been told a million times over. The Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan. As great as that music is, the stories have been done to death.
Sure.
So my idea was to, you know, let's tell the stories in depth of the bands that haven't got the attention that they should have had.
Right.
And, you know, over the years I've done this with, you know, tons and tons of different bands. And so how did I get around to Craig Smith? Getting to the second part of your question.
Yeah.
What happened was, you know, because of the magazine, I get a lot of promos, vinyl CDs in the mail to review. Mm-hmm. And one day I got a CD from a company in Germany of this album, Apache Inca, by Maitreya Kali. I'd heard of this album before, but I'd never listened to it. So I put it on, and I was just completely blown away by how great this music was. I mean, it was just the quality of it. I wasn't expecting what the cover told me. Because I know you've seen the cover artwork. It's very, very strange. It's very amateurish. It's press on letters. Mm-hmm. This eerie face that looks like it's been made on a Xerox machine.
It's very spooky looking. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, those symbols and writing, and then snapshots of this hippie guy, like in different locations, you know, around the world, and these rambling discourse, you know, this manifesto about how he's the new Buddha, the new Messiah, and all this. So I thought, well, this is going to be weird. Let's listen to this. It looks interesting. And I put it on, and it wasn't this rambling, incoherent, disturbed music that I expected it would be. It was a lot of different things. You know, yeah. there were these sort of acoustic solo tracks, which were just really haunting, and his voice was so pure, and you know, and the song level of the songwriting was just so high. You know, here was a guy that knew how to write songs, knew how to sing, knew how to play guitar, and then there were the other tracks that were a full band, and they obviously sounded like they were recorded at a different time, and they sounded to me like the Buffalo Springfield, mm-hmm. or some of the more psychedelic Monkees songs, or the Birds, and they were really good too. Like, they were never released. How could this be? So I thought, this is obviously there's a story behind this.
Yeah.
How did this guy who thinks he's going to be the crown, the king of the world in the year 2000, make this music, which sounds like it could have been heard on the radio? You know, right. Like, he sounds like he could have been, you know, famous. He's good. The quality was good enough where this guy could have been up there. So I started to piece together the story from there. And all I had to go on initially was the artwork of the album. You know, Maitreya Kali, Apache Inca, and, you know, the next Buddha and all this stuff. But it did say that his name was Craig Smith. And that is, and he was born on April 20th of 1945, and so I had a few little things to go on, and I started with that as my sort of, you know, treasure map, as it were, you know, how to find out more about Craig Smith.
Right.
Yeah, and you dug really deep into what was it, his great grandfather?
Well, it took me 15 years to do this, to write this book and to get his story, because it's so difficult when a guy's name is Smith, first of all.
Sure.
Right.
And what I discovered right away was he left behind very little trace of who he was. I learned fairly early on that he'd been homeless for many, many, many years. Mm-hmm. So that means, you know, he didn't leave behind a lot of documentation, you know, homes, rents, you know, car ownership, social security stuff. There really wasn't very much to go on. I even hired a private investigator at one point to help me, and he at least was able to provide me with a few clues, few avenues to pursue. And it just took years and years to piece that together. You know, I'd find somebody who knew him, and they would give me the names of a few other people, and then I'd have to track down them. So it was really like piecing together this giant jigsaw puzzle.
Right.
It was really, I mean, I love, you know, detective novels and, mm-hmm. and yeah. Rockford Files and things like that. So I enjoy that aspect of it, but it's also really hard work, because there's many times where you don't find anything for months and months. It would just come to a complete standstill.
Right. It seems like there's chance, right, in the works and discovering his story, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody had looked for any clues before.
Right.
So I figured if I don't do it, nobody is going to do it.
Right.
Yeah. Man, I just can't believe the endeavor of taking a decade and a half of your life to pursue. I mean, I'm sure you weren't working on it full time, but it was probably always right. in the forefront of your mind that
yeah,
right.
sniffing yeah. for clues.
yeah, he was like, you know, I would dream about him, you know. I would dream mm-hmm. about, you know, finding another clue, finding another photograph, finding where he might be.
Right. And you were writing the book as you were finding these things, or did you gather this information and then write from there?
I sort of gathered it for quite a long time and decided I was going to start with a story in the magazine.
Right.
So it was just a really a matter of, like anything you write, when do you stop? Mm-hmm. You know, and my idea was that I would stop when I found him, you know, and I came close to finding him, you know. I talked to a police officer that regularly had encounters with him because he patrolled that area where he would always be around the same area of North Hollywood and Studio City, mm-hmm. which was actually where he grew up. You know, those were the familiar sites for him. And I also had a couple friends that lived in that area that would spot him. They would see him and even exchange a few words with him. So I'm down in San Diego, so that's, you know, 2-3 hours drive.
Yeah.
Now and then I would drive up, but I never managed to find him. I came close so many times. In fact, I had a friend who was up there the whole summer, and he made a point of going up and down the street many times. And finally, one night, he spotted him. And by this point, I'd arranged for Sundazed Music to release a CD of the Penny Arcade, which was Craig Smith's band. Some of the songs on that album that I talked about, the band stuff. So there was a CD out, and my friend Chris, he had the CD with him, and he had a copy of Ugly Things, and he, you know, he met Craig and gave those to him, and Craig didn't really have much to say. He was just kind of, yeah, you know, and here's the phone number of Mike Stax. He would really like to talk to you and tell your story, and he wants to help you out. Yeah. You know, I must have had people give him my phone number like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
And I always thought that maybe he'd call, and he never did. So eventually, after failing to connect so many times, it was suddenly discovered by one of the friends that was helping me that he died, that his body was in the L.A. morgue and unclaimed. Wow. And he died several months previously. And so at that point, I thought, well, that's the stories. I've written the story. I can finish the story now because I'm not going to meet Craig. This is how it ends. Mm. It ends with him dying in a sleeping bag in a park in North Hollywood.
Beautiful sampan boat sails beyond the sea into the emerald light where we all are free. Gods from an ancient past beckon from the shore as we move on our way into nothing more. Magical sampan boat journeys through the sun, touching the amber light inside everyone. Gem-laden palaces, treasures that abound. Sitar and koto play soothing tranquil sound. It is so clear when your karma loses fear. Peace dwells inside. Down a long hall you may stumble, you may fall.
And the thing was, I'd never had such a huge reaction to a story in the magazine as that one. It resonated with a lot of people in a very personal way. And I got a lot of letters and emails and phone calls from people that were really, really moved by the story. And I realized this story is kind of bigger than the magazine article, and I need to dig deeper. You know, I knew I hadn't told the whole story. There was so many gaps still. And that it resulted finally in the book Swim Through the Darkness.
I think one of the most valuable contributors to this story was Chris Ducey.
Right, yeah. Chris was really crucial to this story. Craig and him were like a musical partnership. You know, they were like a sort of Lennon and McCartney of Penny Arcade, even though they actually wrote their songs separately. They each had their individual songs. So, yeah, Craig and Chris met when they were auditioning for a TV show called The Happeners. These auditions were happening exact same time that the Monkees auditions were happening.
Wow, yeah.
And Craig actually auditioned for the Monkees and for the Happeners. Hmm. And he was on the short list for the Monkees. I think he was in the, you know, top 10 or whatever, but he ended up signing on for The Happiness, which was, The Monkees was about, obviously, a rock band, and The Happiness was about a folk rock group in Greenwich Village. They were more made up of sort of teenage runaways. And so he got cast in that as one of the leads. It was a little more serious than The Monkees. It still had elements of that sort of Beatles Hard Day's Night kind of goofiness, but it also had serious elements because, you know, they were teenage runaways and sleeping in abandoned buildings at night. So they filmed the pilot in New York City at the end of 1965, and ABC was supposed to pick it up and air it starting in the fall of 66, but the execs at ABC watched the pilot and they didn't really know what to make of it, because was it a comedy, was it a drama, was it musical? It kind of had elements of all those things. So they, in the end, they decided, I don't know if we can find the necessary advertisers, so we won't put it on the air. But that's just the way it goes. But the thing was, Chris and Craig met on this show, sang all those songs together, and they found that their voices really blended beautifully. And not only that, they had this similar sort of off-the-wall sense of humor. And they formed a duo called Chris and Craig, and before long, you know, they got a deal with Capitol Records. So, you know, that's really what they wanted to do. Neither of them had acting experience before. So, you know, music was what they did, writing songs and singing them. So anyway, I found Chris, and he actually insisted that I fly up to San Francisco Bay Area where he lived, Marin County, and stay the weekend at his house, because he didn't want to do a long phone conversation on it. And we spent 2 days talking about it, and you know, that really blew the lid off the whole thing, because he knew him so well. He knew Craig so well and worked right alongside him for this period of only about 3 years, but three pretty intense years.
Yeah.
Right.
And they wound up under the umbrella of Mike Nesmith from the Monkees, who you also got to speak with for this project.
Right, yeah. Mike Nesmith, he thought they were like kind of like a quintessence of what Los Angeles music was at that particular time in the 60s. So it's the way they sort of blended folk and rock and country and sort of like the beginnings of psychedelia and the quality of their songwriting. So he signed on as their manager and producer, and he gave them a practice room at his house in the Hollywood Hills, and they would go there 4 or 5 days a week and just, you know, work on their songs. Wow. And then every now and then Mike would take them into the studio. Sometimes he'd take them into RCA Hollywood and use some of the time that the Monkees weren't using. And they recorded an album. And unfortunately, Mike Nesmith was not able to find a label to release the album, so it was shelved. But he was really proud of the fact that he worked with the Petty Arcade, and he still spoke really highly of Craig and Chris and their songwriting. And as you know, one of Craig's songs, the Monkees did, because, you know, one day Mike stuck his head in the practice room at the house, and they were playing a song called Salesman, and Mike thought, oh, that would be perfect for me to sing in the Monkees. Yeah. So they, you know, they did recorded the song Salesman, and of course that made a lot of money for Craig.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, he didn't even have to try to sell it.
Yeah.
No, that's true. But at that point he'd already you know, had one of his songs recorded by Andy Williams, and another thing by the Robs was around the same time. So, yeah, Craig was placing his songs with other people as well.
Right.
Yeah. I was listening to that song by the Robs, Rapid Transit.
Yeah.
And
it's a good one.
Yeah. Great, great garage rock kind of tune. I kind of laughed at one of the lyrics that could be misused or misinterpreted.
Yeah.
You're as useless as the mask you wear. anthem for Karens everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was ahead of his time, I guess, with that one.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, he did like to predict things, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Silent speaking, never trusting each emotion hiding there. Love she could give now is rusting, useless as the mask she wears. Fear will never let her say, sealing never her heart to bear.
Your writing is really authentic and really compelling, and it would be great to hear more of an insight on your writing process. It's inspiring. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I to some extent I used the voices of the people that were there to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because Craig's voice was not available, I tried to piece together the different parts of his life using the people that actually were there experiencing it. So I did use a lot of quotes firsthand,
right,
to paint that picture and to give it authenticity. You know, they were, you know, telling me what they actually saw and experienced about Craig.
Mm-hmm.
And then trying to figure out Craig's motivation, trying to figure out, you know, what caused what, you know, because when there was so little facts, especially in the beginning, you know, you would find fact A and then fact B, and then you would automatically think that was a cause and effect. But then there may have been another thing in between, you know. So
mm-hmm.
It was really, really difficult sometimes to not to jump to conclusions, and I try to avoid that. And you know, just try to tell the story as accurately as possible. And also what I wanted to do was kind of tell the story within the larger context of the historical times that he was moving through, because he was really a product of those times.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You know, like in the 60s, you know, he got caught up in the folk music thing, and then you know, the Beatles and the Birds and the Sunset Strip thing, and then psychedelia and Eastern mysticism, he followed all that along.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 70s, that all burned out.
Yeah.
And then, and that's, you know, as you know, that's when he spent time in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the 70s, he's out of prison, and into the 80s, he becomes homeless, which was really when the homeless population really escalated, was at the beginning of the 80s when they cut all funding for mental health programs under Reagan.
Right.
Yeah, thanks, Reagan.
They turned all those people loose on the streets. A lot of them were Vietnam veterans, so with a lot of damage. A lot of them were drug burnouts. Some of them were people like Craig. And, you know, he lived all through the 80s, all the way until his death in 2013, on the streets, you know, through all that, you know, all that time. So I was trying to also paint a picture of those times. What was it like to be part of the homeless population during the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s?
Right.
So, yeah, it was a lot of different worlds, you know, a changing world, you know, and most of it taking place within this small area of North Hollywood, really.
Yeah, and most of the story, you know, at least of the musical years, that's all happening just in the space of a decade.
Yeah.
He did a lot of living in that short amount of time. And, you know, I think he was one of many unsung messiahs, you know, self,
right?
There was a lot of them around, you know.
And yeah,
that was why he was sort of able to, you know, still function as a member of, you know, just interact with people. And he was like, you know, I'm a guru, I'm the messiah, I can read your mind, I know who you were reincarnated from. Back then, people were just sort of like, oh, okay, you know, that's mm-hmm. interesting.
Someone's out to get you. I think it's gonna be me. Oh, my name.
I remember you were talking in the book to one of his former girlfriends who laughed at the idea when he asked her to call him master. She's like, yeah, that's where I draw the line.
Yeah. Yeah. But they were still people that were interested to learn from him, because he was pretty well read about those metaphysical subjects and things like that. So he could talk a pretty good game. Since then, I've talked to several other women that knew him during that period where he was Maitreya. They all had a similar experience. He was strange, sure. I mean, at one point he had a tattoo of a black widow spider right on his third eye.
Yeah.
Right.
But they were sort of, well, you know, that was just kind of the times that we were living in. One woman told me that she was just walking through, I think, the farmer's market, and he came up to her all dressed in white and said, "I'm your guru."
Wow.
And she was like, well, at that point, I was kind of searching for somebody to give me answers.
Yeah.
So, okay, you're my guru. And, you know, she became more like his girlfriend for a while. But, you know, what could he teach her? It was just different times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now you'd run a mile from something like that.
Sure.
Or it might be branded in a different way now.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it's coming back.
Yeah.
I wonder how it would have turned out if he had amassed a spiritual following in those days. If he would have stuck with it.
Others did, you know. I mean, look at
Charles Manson.
The comparison is Manson, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, also like Father Yod and the Source family, you know, they all managed to amass a following, but he never did. I don't know if he wanted to or not. I think maybe he did, you know. I mean, at that point, his ego was completely out of control, you know, when you think you're when you think you're literally the Messiah and you have superpowers of ESP and such like. Yeah, maybe he wanted that, but he didn't have that. He was always alone.
Yeah.
Just one woman.
And the big part of the mystery was this spider tattoo on his forehead.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something that I discovered early on, because Chip Douglas, who was one of the Monkees' producers, he knew Craig from this happy guy that hung around the Monkees' set, was a friend of Nesmith's, you know, was fun to be around guy. Then he hadn't seen him for many years, I think it must have been 1972, he went into a record store, and Craig came up to him and said, "Hey, you remember me?" You know, he goes, "Oh, are you Craig Smith?" He goes, "Yeah, but I'm Maitreya now. Don't call me that."
Mm-hmm.
And he remembered that he had a tattoo of a Black Widow spider. A couple people had mentioned the Black Widow spider tattoo, and there was no evidence of it actually happening. And then I accessed his prison records and got two mugshots. And there it was. Because it confirmed, I thought maybe, you know, it had been just, you know, a temporary tattoo or painted on or
mm-hmm.
whatever, you know, or he'd misremembered, whatever it was. But here it was on the mugshot. And I kind of really sent a chill down my spine, because I knew later he didn't have it. I knew from people who had met him, you know, like my friend, I took a photograph of him, there was no Black Widow spider. So at some point, while he was in prison, or right after he got out, he got rid of that tattoo.
It's a bold choice.
Yeah.
Getting one of those.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, now, even now, that would, you would do a double take.
Yeah.
But I mean, now, you know, you're used to seeing people with tattoos, you know, pretty much everywhere. But back then, the early 70s, that would have been something that stood out.
Yeah, and an association with Manson completely too, right?
Yeah, him and his friend Jason Lasker used to hang out a lot at Dennis Wilson's house when the Manson people started coming around, and Jason remembered they creeped him out.
It
was like, oh well, they, you know, that they killed the party atmosphere, you know, and if those guys, sure, people were around, you wanted to get out of there pretty fast. They knew it was creepy.
Yeah.
But I do know, you know, that I think that he put that tattoo on his forehead to scare people.
Mm-hmm. It does show in the last recordings that he made that just sort of the isolation and the confusion and the sort of convincing himself of his own mythology.
Yeah. You know, the Apache and Inca album was sort of like his last will and testament to the world, because he knew that he was losing his grip on reality. Even though, you know, maybe he thought he was a messiah, I don't think he thought that 24 hours a day. You know, he was a smart guy, and I don't think you are delusional 24 hours a day with something like that. I think it's something that you kind of try to convince yourself of. So I think he put that together, all of his best music, his solo recordings, the Penny Arcade recordings, and he put them on these albums. And I mean, and then he only pressed up like 100 copies of each or something like that, or maybe 200 copies of each. And he put all his manifesto and listed all the people that he liked, and he pictures of where he places he'd been. And he gave these to people, gave them to friends, handed them out on the street. And I think that was just his kind of say, you know, this is my life up to this point. This is my work. This is what I've accomplished. And who knows where I'm going to be after this. But just in case, you know. And it, so I likened it to like a message in a bottle almost, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Within months of him pressing up those albums, you know, he
right.
had a complete breakdown and physically assaulted his mother. Mm-hmm. And was jailed, you know, sentenced to 5 years to life for attempted murder, which they talked down to assault with a deadly weapon.
Yeah.
So and then was homeless from that point on after prison. So, you know, he was right. You know, that was the end. You know, that really was the end. So I felt that he'd cast that out there like a message in a bottle, and I'd found it. I got the message from Craig, you know, like, tell my story, you know. That's right. Kind of what I felt, you know, tell the world what happened, you know,
right.
for whatever reason, you know, just so he wouldn't be forgotten, you know, I think really is what it is. I mean, people would appreciate his music, because that's really what he was all about, was his songs.
This is Low Profile. I'm Markley Morrison. Today, Madison, Nadine, and I are speaking with music historian Mike Stacks about the life of 1960s musician Craig Smith, later known as Maitreya.
There are some times inside my rhymes when all the geometry tumbles all around me. There are some places
sometimes I just wonder, like, if there was more support for people that struggle with mental illness, what could have been different for Craig, you know?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we should talk about, there was a turning point, you know, which was kind of the pivotal moment of the book of, you know, how did wholesome, talented, charismatic Craig Smith become this sinister Maitreya Kali guru guy?
Yeah.
That was kind of my initial impetus, you know. How did this turn into this?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
From being on the Andy Williams show as a part of this group, the Good Time Singers, smiling and wearing a, you know,
that name is too perfect, by the way.
yeah. They were the most wholesome, you know, group there it possibly is. It's like, you know, when you watch the movie Mighty Wind, the Main Street Singers are basically the Good Time Singers.
Yep.
How did he go from that to being this guy with a black widow spider on his forehead, you know? And when Craig left the Penny Arcade with all his record royalties from the Monkees and Andy Williams songs, he went to travel in Europe and then along the hippie trail from Turkey to India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And while he was in Afghanistan, I managed to track down a couple of women who traveled with him for part of the journey, so I was able to find out what happened. While he was in Kandahar in Afghanistan, he apparently was walking through the marketplace and picked up a knife, and then he was taking LSD almost daily at this point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then he was seen being chased by a group of men, like, over the hillside and out of sight. The next thing is he was in a lunatic asylum in Kandahar, calling, managed to get a hold of his lawyer. He'd been robbed, he'd been beaten, he'd been raped. They'd urinated on him and left him for dead, like, basically, in the desert. And he'd ended up, you know, hauled away to this mental hospital. And he was eventually able to get word back to his lawyer and get a passport and continue his travels. But after that, he was never the same. When he came back from that, he wasn't Craig Smith anymore. He didn't want to be called Craig Smith. He was Maitreya. And he was a completely changed person. Everybody that knew him before said, "What happened?" You know, he was so happy and goofy and fun, and now he's scary.
Hmm.
Yeah,
it's talking, like, all this weird stuff. You know?
This traumatic event is, like, almost stuck inside of Craig. It seems like this trauma. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a PTSD type situation.
Right.
He came back convinced he was Jesus and Buddha rolled into one, and that seemed to be him to be the best option. Which of course was, you know, a bad, I don't know if you could call it a choice, but it wasn't going to have a happy end.
Right.
When you consider what he could have done, you know, when he had people like Glenn Campbell recording his songs and playing them on TV.
Right.
I mean, he could have been, you know, with those songs alone, you know, he could have lived a reasonably comfortable life for many years, and he could have kept doing it. You know, Glenn Campbell wanted more songs from him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then I think he met Craig, who by that point was Maitreya, and thought, well, you know, maybe cross that guy off the list.
Wow. Uh-huh.
You know? And, you know, same with Andy Williams. Andy Williams did two of his songs, you know? They sold, you know, over a million copies each. But, you know, pretty soon they would make sure they weren't going to return his calls or have anything to do with Maitreya.
And Craig was able to write songs, like, with, like, a target audience in mind, too. Like, the Christmas song that he wrote for Andy Williams is just, like, pulling from the zeitgeist of these are the ingredients of a classic Christmas song. I'm just going to, like, throw them all in there.
Yeah, it's, like, really corny, but it perfectly fits into the context of that album, you know? And the rest of that Andy Williams Christmas album is all standard Christmas stuff, you know, Silver Bells and, you know, Sleigh Ride and all those songs, except for one song by Craig Smith, and it fits right in there. So yeah, he could do that. He could do that. That was the thing too, when he came back as Maitreya, people said, you know, he would be at a party with him and he would be talking, and he'd be just talking sort of like this psychobabble, metaphysical, mystical stuff that was like, you pretty much wanted to tune out. But then someone would hand him a guitar and he would start singing one of his songs, and all of a sudden, boom, here was a completely clear-headed and likable person. Like, in the moment while he was playing the song, it was all his talent was there and all his focus, and everything was back. And, you know, and I looked into that a bit, and it's true with people that suffer from schizophrenia that they can find focus with music.
Right.
Listening to it and especially playing it, because it sort of makes all their mental facilities focus in on the creating and the performing of the song. Yeah. So they're not flying off in a million different directions, which is what, you know, schizophrenia does. Mm-hmm. You know, you're looking for meaning in meaningless stuff that's everywhere. You know, you see a, you know, a piece of paper on the ground, and that's a message. And then, you know, a bird flies past, and that's something else, you know. And pick up a guitar and play a song that you wrote, or pick up a guitar and write a song, and it can be, and you can do it. And then the amazing thing that I discovered after the book came out, I connected with Craig's brother Gary, who had been trying to reach this entire time, and for obvious reasons decided he didn't want to talk to me. But till the book came out, and then we got in contact.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was gonna ask about Gary. Yeah.
So he's like, okay, I realize now that it's happening, so I might as well, you know. I convinced him, you know, I'm not exploiting your brother, and I'm sincere, and so we became friends, and he helped me release a lot of Craig's unreleased music because he'd held on to it. But what turned out was that even while Craig was homeless, as late as the mid-90s, he would still, when he had a little bit of money, go into a studio and record demos of songs that he'd write.
Is that right?
New songs, yeah. There's like an album's worth of songs that he recorded in the 90s.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of them are really good.
Wow.
He could still write hooky, melodic songs. I think he'd lost some of his vocal ability. He can still sing fine, but he buries his voice in the mix.
Uh-huh.
And I think he felt like he didn't have that pure voice that he once had, but he could certainly still write songs. One song I put as a bonus track on an album we compiled called Love Is Our Existence, a song called Waves, which is sort of a, in the style of the Beach Boys, and it's a beautiful song, and a lot of people tell me that's one of their favorite songs that they've heard of his.
Can we hear that right now?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Great.
When Gary and I connected, I realized that he had a real love for Craig's music. I went to his house, his apartment, and on the dining room table he had stacked up acetates and tapes that he'd kept of Craig's, that Craig had given to him for safekeeping during times where he was homeless and didn't have any place to put them. So there was dozens and dozens of songs. And then also cassette tapes and DATs from the 90s. So we basically started a business together, Matreya Apache Music, to sort of look after Craig's music, you know, because, you know, the Apache Inca CD, the one that I got originally, and that also came out on vinyl, you know, that was a label in Germany that just put it out.
Right.
They didn't have the rights or anything like that, and they sold quite a lot of copies of that. So we just wanted to take control of the rights to everything and make sure that it went to Craig's family, which is Gary. And myself, you know, I get a cut of it as the guy that kind of helped to kind of brings Craig's story back, you know. And I think Craig would be happy with what we're doing, you know. And I think all he wanted was for his music to be heard. So that's what we're trying to do, Gary and I.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm glad it's found its way into the right hands.
Yeah.
You know, and that you hold his story so dear and conveyed it in such an earnest way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Really, man, I need to take pointers from you. Really do your homework. And
oh, thanks.
I feel like it's really encouraging for me as a writer and researcher as well.
Yeah, me too. Well,
thanks. I mean, I always like it when I read someone's, you know, books or articles where they've actually uncovered everything, you know.
Yeah.
They haven't left a lot of loose ends. You know, when I'm reading books, a lot of times I'm like, why didn't they check into this and this and this holes here? So I always figured a lot of these stories that I tell in Ugly Things, and of course Craig's story, they're only going to maybe get told once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, let's do it right. And the other thing is, the time is running out on a lot of these stories. You know, that generation from the 60s, you know, those musicians now are there in their late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them had already died, and others will be dying in the next 10 to 20 years. So time is running out, and a lot of them are also losing their memories, you know.
True.
So it definitely, I feel now, I've just got to try to document these stories properly while these people are still around. I'm already at the point where I find that I'm talking to people's children, you know, people's mm-hmm. grown-up children. Because the actual person is gone.
Mm.
And, you know, that's not optimum. You know, you want to ideally be talking to the person who experienced it, mm-hmm. and the people who were there. That's why what you're doing is important, too, with your podcast, because you're getting at these stories out there, you know, like Bobby Brown and people like that, you know, people whose stories have never been told. You
right.
know, and that's great. I really appreciate what you're doing. You're doing a great job with it.
No. Mm. Thank you.
It's true.
Yeah,
we got to make, there's some stories that are told over and over, like you said at the beginning, and then it's fun to, you know, build a timeline in our own network of information. So you really set a precedent.
Well, as we know, the best, most interesting, or most innovative music is not the stuff that necessarily sold the most at the time and is the best known.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same way that, you know, McDonald's hamburgers are not the best hamburgers in the world.
Right.
So, you know, that's the thing, is to uncover this really good music. You know, it's not just the also-rans. It's like people that really had great, great music that was overlooked and might otherwise have been forgotten.
Right.
You know, especially in Craig's case, because none of it was ever commercially released. So it could have been completely forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
So, I feel, you know, that's one of the things I'm most proud about, is that I got that music out there into the world.
Yeah, it's beautiful stuff.
Best burger in the world? What's your take on that?
There's a place called Starlight Room where I like their burgers a lot, you know. But
nice.
These days I'm not eating too much red meat.
Mm-hmm. That's good for the earth, I suppose.
Yeah. Everybody's probably got... You probably have your favorite burger place near where you live. It's the local burger that's going to be the best one.
Right.
True. Do you want to tell the listener about... You got a slew of bands that you've been a part of.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, right now, my band is The Loons. We've been playing for many, many years at this point, and we're working on... We've been writing songs for a new album.
Mind is leaving this world. It's on you heavy when I fall.
people find Ugly Things?
Ugly-things.com. And you can get to the web store from there, where you can order back issues and you can order Craig Smith's music and the book, Swim Through the Darkness, which, you know, you can also get on Amazon, obviously, and all the other all places where good books are sold.
Awesome.
Great. Okay, well,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. This has been really enlightening, and you've been very generous with your time.
Oh, thanks. I mean, I love talking about this stuff.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
All right, have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Your mind is leaving this world. Don't you hear me when I call?
This has been the 73rd episode of Low Profile. I'm Markley Morrison. Special thanks to Madison Nadine for co-hosting this one with me. We were speaking with music historian Mike Stax about the early life of 1960s musician Craig Smith, later known as Maitreya. You can find links to Mike's work and other related materials on this episode's website at lowprofilepodcast.com. The song High and Lonesome by his band The Loons is what we're hearing now. Low Profile receives in-kind support from Schirler Easy Premium Shitty American Lager by Three Magnets Brewing Company, Old School Pizzeria, Rainy Day Records, San Francisco Street Bakery, and of course, support from you via patreon.com/lowprofile. Thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend. Catch you next time.